This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is John Cass.
Good morning, everyone.
The only relevant columnist in Chicago anymore. Well, my opinion.
Some think so.
You don't have happily. Yeah, I'm one of them. So we're happy to have you, John. And as I tweeted out to you yesterday, I just wanted to brace you. The gift I was going to bring is a thank you for filling in for Amy J. It's on back order.
Oh, the Bernie Sanders mittens.
So you can look forward to those maybe a week to 2 weeks. I don't know. You know how hand-sewn Vermont mittens go. It's hard to tell when they may be delivered.
Anyone who's up this early should realize that this is Dan's descent into sentimental barbarism, yeah, where he's going to give me some mittens.
I just like.
I'd much rather have the real thing, Bernie Sanders himself, so I can put him as a dibs marker sitting on his folding chair.
Sure.
In front of my house.
Sure.
In front of the apartment.
Yeah, sure. As a Chicago resident now, you need that. I was just excited about the whole mittens thing.
Because you can't use not for religious figures, but we can use Bernie.
Well, he's a religious figure to some.
Yeah.
But it wasn't for the memes that have been going around. It was just fun to see that there's an entrepreneur who exists in Bernie universe. I mean, that was the wild thing. All right, impeachment 2.0. Word came down on Friday that the article will be delivered today. The impeachment trial will start the week of February 8th. And interesting opinions about it, really unsurprising opinions considering the sources. But you've got on the Republican side, because that's what's relevant here, can they get 17 Republicans to convict to the extent that that's even relevant? I'm sort of the camp of Dershowitz. Even if you convict him, if he wants to run again in 2024, he runs again in 2024 and he challenges the court in terms of the impeachment, the ability to impeach after he has left office as illegitimate. You can challenge that ruling, too. So, I mean, just because you go through this motion, it could mean that he would be done politically, Trump. It doesn't necessarily mean that he couldn't come back and run in 2024 because he could ultimately send another case hurtling towards the Supreme Court with respect to the constitutionality of pursuing a conviction after a president has left office.
An impeachment of a president is a highly political act, Dan.
I've heard.
And as such, would Mitch McConnell want not only Trump impeached, but also Hawley and Cruz impeached so that he can rid himself of these? Will anyone rid me of these accursed conservatives?
Yes. 312-642-5600, turkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turkey.pro text line. I just don't see, I mean, just speaking of McConnell as it's a completely political animal, how would him helping to whip the necessary 17 Republicans to convict Trump, how does that help him become Senate Majority Leader again? How does that set Republicans up for the 2022 cycle exactly?
Not well.
I mean, that would be the worst call since Matt LaFleur didn't keep the ball in Aaron Rodgers' hands on fourth and goal.
It was tough.
I mean, but I don't understand. I don't understand McConnell's speech last week
in
the well
on.
Of the
yes,
Senate. And I don't understand the prospect that he would actually move to vote to convict, number one. Number two, that he would try to, by extension, whip other Republicans to lock down the commitment. What's he want to do? He wants to make a symbolic vote to convict while they fail to get the 17 Republicans necessary to convict. So then he would either be showing weakness or he becomes just sort of a virtue signaling simp like the left.
They're all virtue signaling.
Well, what's the play?
The play is McConnell doesn't sees conservatives as a problem.
Yeah.
He's a creature of the establishment, the Washington establishment. I call the combine in Illinois is no different from the combine in Washington, as Dan Proft has said.
That is slight. The term we use is institutionalist.
Is that the new one?
He's an institutionalist. Don't you always hear that with respect to McConnell from left media? When McConnell's doing something they want him to do, like going after Trump, he's an institutionalist. He has such regard for the Senate. He's trying to protect the institution. Now, when he's actually blocking any of the left-wing gambits of Joe Biden or Barack Obama before him, you know, then he's an impediment to democracy. But when he's doing their bidding, he's an institutionalist.
Is that when the anal retentive chef himself, Chris Wallace, walks behind him with a jester's rattle and rattles his praise?
Well, but go back to your point. He wants to jettison conservatives. Number one, he can't do that just by the nature of the states and his caucus. But number two, so what is the play for him? Do you think even indulging this hysteria surrounding impeachment 2.0? I would think initially, and frankly, the more distance you get from the Trump presidency to the impeachment, that this is just a pro forma exercise for everybody to serve their base. But McConnell's not serving his base.
Rand Paul is serving his.
We'll get to Rand Paul. Ed in Oakbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, my question is, during this impeachment hearing, because if I remember the last time, they were bringing up all kinds of stuff, will they be able to bring up the voter irregularities, like in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, and so forth? That's what I'd like to see.
That's not going to happen.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Well,
I don't see why not. They're going to bring the whole kitchen thinking.
I agree with Dan. Yeah. It's not going to happen.
Thanks for the call. No, they're going to narrowly tailor
firewall.
This. Well, not to mention, I mean, if you're arguing against the conviction, you want to just stay focused on the matter at hand, which is to say incitement to sedition, dereliction of duty, these sorts of arguments that will be made. So let's just go chapter and verse.
I make it as a political argument that the president was badly served by his legal brain trust leading up to this, badly served by his advisors and his own ego, and led himself to a catastrophe in which he did egg on, incite the crowd. Did he incite them to, did he say, storm the Capitol against the law? No. So I still don't understand how you can impeach a man who's no longer president.
I think that we've talked about this.
Yes,
there's another op-ed in the Journal over the weekend from a legal scholar making the case that you can pursue trial after an official has left office. So I think there's reasonable arguments on both sides of whether you can do it. But then you get to the substance of it, and I just don't see like what our friend Andy McCarthy sees with respect to this 2.0. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey Dan, John Kiss. Good morning.
Hey,
thanks,
Craig,
for taking the call. Listen, McConnell and these other Republicans that are jacking around with Trump here on this, I mean, that they got to be the dumbest dumbest politicians in town and everything like that. But all of us out here and everything like that see this, I mean, that. That guy goes and messes around like already. McConnell, I got no use for that guy. You know, my dad. These guys are idiots for doing this kind of thing, jerking around with Trump now. And and the thing with John was talking about the incited. What about all these dumb rats? All the statements they make and everything that's way, way, way worse with all the stuff going on all summer long, tearing up our city and everything like that. What were they doing?
Thanks for the call, Craig.
They were getting ready for the election.
Yeah, I mean, there is something that you said that John, that I don't think we can gloss over, and we haven't here, but it bears repeating in the context, which is to say, you know, his public excoriation of Pence.
Oh, that was terrible.
On Twitter and elsewhere, his suggestion at that rally that we're going to go, you know, hopefully Mike Pence does the right thing. It turned out Mike Pence did the right thing. He didn't run afoul of his constitutional responsibilities / limitations. So So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
He behaved horribly. I've said before he owes Mike Pence a public apology. That was absurd what he did. The indulging the Lynn Woods and the Sidney Powells over the weeks, not helpful. It was, frankly, it turned out to be counterproductive is generous.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Pagliacci Schumer took to the Senate floor on Friday to describe what this impeachment is all about.
Donald John Trump incited the insurrection.
Well, I thought maybe we had gone back to the Clinton eras and we were going to try Monica Lewinsky for some such.
Well, obviously, what's in your mind comes out your mouth.
Something, by the way, Hillary Clinton never accused of. On the topic of impeachment 2.0, there was a predicate conversation that Rand Paul had with George Stephanopoulos, because Stephanopoulos wants, you know, Republicans like so many of them, you have to say it. I want you to say it. Say the election wasn't stolen. We can't talk about anything else unless you sign on the dotted line that the election wasn't stolen. And Rand Paul wasn't having it. This was really instructive because it's such a tutorial in how the D.C. press corps works to advance their position to tell a story, particularly when they're a little light on the facts.
Hey, George, where you make a mistake is that people coming from the liberal side like you, you immediately say everything's a lie instead of saying there are two sides to everything. Historically, what would happen is if I said that I thought there was fraud, you would interview someone else who said there wasn't. But now you insert yourself in the middle and say the absolute fact is that everything I'm saying is a lie.
Well, because, Senator, I said what the president said was a lie because he said, hold on a second. He said the election was stolen. This election was not stolen. The results were certified in every single state after counts and recounts.
You're saying that absolutely it was, you're saying there was no fraud in it's all been investigated. That's just not true.
So it's not what I said, sir. I said the Department of Justice found no evidence.
Let me finish
my point.
No, you said something that was not true. You say we're all liars. You're just simply saying we're all liars. And
I said it was a lie that the election was stolen.
Premise that you're right and we're wrong. Let's talk about the specifics of it. In Wisconsin, tens of thousands of absentee votes had only the name on them and no address. Historically, those were thrown out. This time, they weren't. They made special accommodations because they said, oh, it's a pandemic, and people forgot what their address was. So they changed the law after the fact. That is wrong. That's unconstitutional. And I plan on spending the next 2 years going around state to state and fixing these problems. And I won't be cowed by liberals in the media who say, there's no evidence here and you're a liar if you talk about election fraud. No, let's have an open debate. It's a free country. I voted to certify the state electors because I think it would be wrong for Congress to overturn that. But at the same time, I'm not willing just to sit here and say, oh, everybody on the Republican side is a liar and there is no fraud. No, there were lots of problems and there were secretaries of state who illegally changed the law, and that needs to be fixed, and I'm going to work hard to fix it.
He also, look, it is the reason why, listening to that, reminded me why I voted for Rand Paul for president in the Republican primary. This is why I wanted Rand Paul, not Donald Trump. Because he's consistent, ideologically consistent. And he took down, in the part you didn't run, he took down George Stephan. He chopped him down bad. Well, I mean, it was just pathetic. I'm looking at George and thinking, man, are you Greek or what?
Well.
Come on, man.
Well, here's the thing. Rand Paul makes arguments, and he knows exactly what hacks masquerading as journalists like Clinton Foundation Donor Zero are trying to do. You're trying to say, if I question anything that happened with the administration of the elections, state by state, then I'm saying the election was stolen. So now I have to repeat your line that ends debate. And then I have to listen to you repeat to me things I know that are in furtherance of the misdirection play. Bill Barr said there was no evidence of substantial fraud. Stephanopoulos saying, you know, no election is perfect. I'm sorry here. What did we have? We had an unprecedented election because of the mail-in balloting. Unprecedented. And that brought with it all sorts of other unprecedented moves by administrative executives like secretaries of state. He mentioned Wisconsin. Obviously, you could throw in a number of other states. And courts of law that acted as legislative bodies, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is at the top of that list. How is that not legitimate? My position has been the same as Rand Paul's, which is to say, I don't know if all of these irregularities would rise to the level of changing the outcome. I don't know. But the idea that they're not, you can't talk about them. They're not worth exploring.
That's what the left is all about.
And you want to, the fact is this. This is a fact. Well, it's also a fact what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did. It's also a fact what the Wisconsin Secretary of State did with respect to the designated, you know, indefinitely confined so they didn't have to abide the voter ID law in Wisconsin. It's also a fact that Brad Raffensperger cut this deal with Stacey Abrams that essentially was an end run around the Georgia state legislature.
Is that the one that her sister ruled on from the federal bench?
Right. But, I mean, you know, it's like you can't talk about those. Otherwise, you're some crank howling at the moon saying the election was stolen.
Yeah.
I don't know if the election was stolen. And George, you don't either, which is why we need to do exactly what Rand Paul said and why Republican state legislators and churs need to make sure they retain their power in these states where there are all these questions about how the elections were administered.
If you pull this up to the 40,000 feet level, what you see is two things to me. One is this is a serious issue that won't get solved until people are allowed to talk about it in their states. The second issue, because many people have questions, 74 million people are questioning the election. That's not good for the country. The second thing is, politically.
Right, and by the way, just hold on the second thing. Right, that's not good for the country, and the left's response is shut up.
That's all they are.
Rather than explain. Yeah. Make your argument, right?
Right, and the second thing is, it shows me Rand Paul's running, well, if not running for president, at least understands the country in a different way than does Mitch McConnell. McConnell is pursuing the impeachment or playing that game that we talked about. Rand Paul is going to be out in the states dealing with what the people realize is important, whether they call themselves conservatives or not.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is an obvious point, but it should be stated explicitly. I'm sorry, Mitch McConnell and Republicans, you want to take the position of Brad Raffensperger, you're just going to be cowed by the George Stephanopoulos of the world, right, and go on with it. You know, I mean, they've already moved. One of the first acts in the House for this session was to move legislation to codify mail-in voting and to expand early voting.
Hey, the guy who owns the Washington Post doesn't want mail-in voting for his companies.
Right. Yes.
Jeff Bezos.
Mail-in voting for America's unwashed masses, but not Amazon's.
Right.
No, exactly. So you want to get back down by them and just concede their points, which is in furtherance of rerunning 2020 in perpetuity.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that is advantageous for free and fair elections that people have confidence in? Oh, and by the way, that increases your chances of electoral success or decreases them? I mean, even from a Machiavellian political perspective, this makes no sense, much less from a law and order perspective.
To me, the most important thing for the American people is to have confidence in their elections. You can't do that if you're told to shut up. You can't discuss it. There are serious questions. Trump screwed up. He was irresponsible. I understand that. I've said that. So have you. But the larger question for the country, for all of us in this country, is to have confidence in our elections, and Rand Paul's trying to address that, while George Stephanopoulos and that crew of Washington Beltway media is trying to shut him up.
I wish somebody would just push back on this, you know, this sort of cavalier attitude towards election irregularities, if not outright fraud. And by the way, I mean, there's been some election fraud arrests in the last couple of weeks in Texas and Louisiana. This stuff happens. And in one case, at least, it was on behalf of Republicans. And of course, good. I don't care. If you're committing fraud, you're committing fraud. I don't care who it's in advance of. The whole point is to have faith in the elections. And when George Stephanopoulos said, no election is perfect, I mean, that sort of wave off is fantastic. Okay, George, So whose vote is it okay to take away? Yours? Somebody who is a lesser of yours? Somebody just out there on the hustings who doesn't have a big job on in the D.C. press corps? I mean, I understand it's not going to be perfect, but the dismissive attitude toward the structural issues that are being raised, in addition to the particularly parochial ones about dead people voting and people out of state voting and people who are not citizens voting. Oh, it's just, it's okay if we take away a certain percentage of votes. We're not even going to care about it, rather than striving to eliminate fraud and the possibility of it as much as humanly possible.
It does nothing to build bridges in a country that's been torn up. Nothing. All it does is exacerbate the tension, and that's not good for the country. Forget the politics or the partisanship. It's not good for the country.
Will and Skokie, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys, how you doing? It's nice to talk to two of the most intelligent men that I respect. Anyway, on a Monday, too.
Thank you. John, do you have a mouse in your pocket? Who's he speaking? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No,
go
it's just you guys
Schumer.
You actually make arguments. You actually make cogent arguments. Anyway, the thing people have to remember, the whole election conspiracy stuff that Stephanopoulos and other people are bringing up is in itself a narrative conspiracy. No one's saying, and at least not, we don't have any evidence that we could have overturned the election. There was fraud. There was not so much fraud, but just stupidity. People don't realize that national elections are carried out on the local level, and fraud occurs on the local level, usually in the precinct level, if Chicago was any example. I was a precinct captain, I'm sorry, not a precinct captain, an election judge for like 15 years, 16 years since when I turned 18. I would do it every year. And the stuff I saw was amazing.
Is that when Eddie Verdoliak used to bring the candy to the polling places for the judges?
Yeah. Right. I actually had a precinct captain. We were doing registration, and the precinct captain, we had three people come in. This was in Logan Square, and they were Hispanic. And the precinct captain says, well, you can't register them. They're not citizens. And they said, we're from Puerto Rico. And I turned to the precinct captain and said, yeah, Puerto Rico is part of the United States. They can register. They're citizens. And the precinct captain got pissed on me. And what happened was my building, I got a building code violation against it. But the point was that it's not usually evil or conspiracy. What it is it's just freaking incompetence. Because these people, they're city workers. They can't really find a job in the real world for the most part. I mean, there are some good city workers and state workers and county workers. But most of them are just people who were, you know, somebody's brother-in-law who can't make it in the world other than having, you know, a city job. And they really, government is incompetent by definition. All government standards by definition are arbitrary. And this is what people fail to realize. Sure, there were irregularities. Sure, there was people who you know violated the law. And most judges don't want to get in the middle of it. Most judges say, hey, "Look, this is a political question.
That's right.
I don't want to get in the middle of it."
That's
and that,
right.
And you know, when you hear Stephanopoulos, well, all of these things were thrown out by judges, and some of them were Trump judges. Geez, they were thrown out for technical standing purposes.
Yeah,
they
a
had
point
nothing
that he
to do
made.
With the actual evidence of the case.
A point that
you know?
Thanks for the
Paul
call,
made.
Will. Yeah,
Thank
that's
you.
Right. That's right. Look, he's right about the competence factor too, and that's not mentioned enough. But I go back to this John Solomon piece, and by the way, David Plouffe, Obama's campaign manager, wrote a book about what they were going to do. So he laid it out. But this is what they did. They targeted.
I thought it was Plouffe.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like Smollett. They targeted those metropolitan areas in those swing states. So you want to understand one part of the reason of what happened in those urban areas in those key states in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and Georgia and even Arizona. They looked at this opportunity that mass mail-in voting presented, and they went to change the rules, relax the standards, petition the secretaries of state, triangulate the issue in those areas.
And
this is one of the reasons why you saw the vote jacked up, arguably, why you saw the vote turnout jacked up in those areas, even as Biden ran behind Hillary Clinton in so many other urban areas around the country. The Democrats, by Labor Day, were already zeroed in on those areas and were prosecuting a strategic approach to maximizing their advantage. And this was one of the problems in 2020 as well. The Democrats were playing a strategic game and Republicans were playing a tactical one.
Where were the Republicans?
Look, I mean, there were...
Where were the Republicans in Pennsylvania? I think
Republican state legislatures in those states have a lot of questions to answer. I mean, Judicial Watch was trying to come over the top and litigate, but you needed Republican state legislators and legislatures, those that are controlled by Republicans in some of those states, to act and not, to not be asleep at the switch. And I think it's difficult to argue they weren't. John in Bridgeport.
Couple things. Mr. Cass, I'm glad you're back. I got 3-1 odds says Alderman Burke will beat the upcoming court case on him. Number two, hats off to Ron Paul.
Yeah.
Didn't he get mugged and jumped over the summer by those Antifa people over in Washington, D.C.?
It was a mostly peaceful mugging.
Yeah, mostly peaceful.
Yeah. But
mugging.
Still, he came back.
They were just trying to beat the hell out of his wife.
He came back firing away, and hats off to him. And number three, what scenario, you two, can you bring a fraudulent case to the courts? Is there one? Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call, John. Tim in Genoa.
Yeah, Dan, John, great show. I just wanted to posit something before I say this. I'm no fan of Cocaine Mitch, but here's what I think happened.
I think
that Biden and Schumer probably think this impeachment thing is going nowhere, as does McConnell. But Biden and Schumer are locked into this because of their base. McConnell might have made a deal under the bench and told Biden and Schumer, okay, look, I will throw Trump under the bus publicly if you guys promise me, because he's a creature of the Senate, for the next 2 years at least, that you will not deal with Washington, D.C. statehood, that you will not throw the process that the Republicans use for
filibuster,
the filibuster, and also that they won't try and pack the court. I think McConnell might have made that deal knowing that this is going nowhere no matter what happens, but he wants to preserve the Senate.
How about this? Let him bring it up and see what happens in the midterm elections. Let them even discuss it and see what happens.
Jim in Crown Point.
This is the difference between a Republican and a Democrat. We all agree that Trump made mistakes. They all lined up behind a guy that would be the dumbest guy in an old people's home. Not one of them pointed out his declining faculties. Chris Wallace said that was the best speech he'd ever heard. How the hell can you say that?
Such a tool.
There's no question. Joe Biden has been metamorphosized into Christ Gandhi.
Because I made this cake, and it was a beautiful cake. And someone left it out in the rain.
Oh, yeah. Goodness.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J is John Cash, Chicago Tribune columnist.
The lovely John Cash.
Lovely and leggy. And
all 18 inches of inseam.
Don't call it a strike. Do not call it a strike.
What? Wait. Come to work. The kids are ready to go to school. Please come to work. We're opening schools. You don't come to school. It's not a strike. What is it?
It's a walkout. A strike would be in violation of the collective bargaining agreement. So
we can't
call it a strike, so we just changed the terms. I mean, the left is good at changing the definition, I should say.
You mean the deal where they got more money than God, and the city couldn't afford it, but they larded it up?
Yeah. Well, being the highest paid teachers in the nation at the end of this contract, I mean, they were adjusted for sort of median household income, they already were. But, I mean, being the highest paid teachers in the country, gross. You don't want to give them time to spend some of that money. You know, get the economy jump started. You don't want them, like, having to spend all their time in the classroom.
Right.
You got to give them some latitude. Chicago Teachers Union voting to defy the order of K through eighth grade teachers returning to the classrooms today. And students in kindergarten through eight are set to return a week later.
So Lori Lightfoot,
February 1st. And so CPS right now pushed the return date to Wednesday, this Wednesday, the 27th. As
I don't want to hear CPS does.
Negotiations continue.
What does the mayor do? Don't tell me CPS. She's the mayor. What are you doing, Lori? People want to get their kids in school. She fought. She went out and picked a fight with the coppers. Okay, I get it. But now the teachers that you gave all that money to are basically sticking it to you. So what are you going to do, Lori Lightfoot?
Well, here's the – wait, are you saying the mayor's in charge of the schools? That's a separate taxing body, John. They have a superintendent. They've got a school board.
You know, I'm sorry to disabuse you of the notion that so many people in media, or at least pretend, particularly broadcast, pretend that schools are separate from the mayor. Yeah, she's the mayor. She's in charge. That's her school system. That's her policy. And the Chicago Teachers Union are basically telling her, in no uncertain terms, to go jump, even as they do themselves, jumping and frolicking, stretching, as they do in their modern dance routine.
It's a remarkable statement that CPS issued.
So stupid.
CPS and CTU have been meeting over the weekend with the goal of reaching an agreement that provides for a smooth expansion of in-person learning. We now agree on far more than we disagree, but our discussions mm-hmm. remain ongoing. So this is sort of the definition of negotiating with terrorists. At minimum, it's the definition of negotiating from a position of weakness, even though you're ostensibly in charge of the system. But in case
Dan Proft brought this up months and months ago when he talked about Russian history, there were the Bolsheviks and the, what were they called?
Mensheviks.
Is Lori Lightfoot the Menshevik in this equation?
Well, we understand who ultimately won the day, and that's who's winning the day in this city. I mean, it's instructive because in case you have any friends, if you listen to this show, you know you're enlightened, or you have been, that the teachers' union runs the school. And I think a lot of suburban families who thought it was different in the suburbs with respect to who's in charge of the school have learned otherwise through the pandemic as well. So I hope everybody is disabused of the notion of who's in charge. Certainly Lori Lightfoot has been disabused of the notion that she's in charge. And then we get this. I obviously on radio, because this is not a visual medium, this will not be done justice, but please do go. I tweeted it out yesterday.
Tweet it again.
I will tweet it out again per John Cass. And listen and watch, really. This is the tweet from this. So, you know, you think I'm making this up. I'm trying to be smart, Alec. No. This is the tweet from the Chicago Teachers Union Twitter account over the weekend. Six of our rank-and-file dance teachers come together to use their art form as a voice to express their desire to feel safe amidst CPS teacher return policy. They stand in solidarity with all educators at risk because no one, John, should have to choose between life and livelihood. They are nothing if not consistent. They call this piece guaranteed seven-figure pension.
No, they don't.
Make it make sense.
Bend and
safety.
Stretch the arms.
Is essential.
Jete.
Oh,
keep
the wife has taught you some of the terminology.
And our teachers safe.
It's like Twyla Tharp in politics. My favorite is the one on the bridge.
Yeah.
Dancing, all in black and white.
It's
star.
Our livelihood versus our lives.
But listen to the overlay. I mean, this is something, really is something out of an Orwell novel.
Yeah.
Just like repeat the catchphrases. Mm-hmm. Our lives for our livelihood.
In this
safety.
Moment,
listen.
Be safe.
Peace. All animals are equal.
Dance? Come on.
All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Children.
Not the children. Just imagine Dan Prof in a leotard doing this.
I could. I'm limber. I want this to be your music bed. For the rest of the show, John Cass is going to speak to this music bed.
Safe.
Be safe. Safe. Lives, livelihood. This is pathetic.
And Finn.
Listen, my wife.
And by the way, I'm not, you know, look, I am a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
If I do say so myself. I enjoy a Joffrey ballet, sort of. I enjoy a Hubbard Street Dance Theater performance.
Right.
Sort of. Not my favorite art form.
No, this is, so I'm, everyone listening,
yeah.
This Dan Proft and I, in the, like, think of it in the 90s, okay? We're wearing black t-shirts. We're at Lynx Hall. It's really hot. And there's no air conditioning, and we're watching modern dancers.
Before there was Sprockets, there was John Cass.
Yes, and then we'd go out for sushi.
And I would never touch his monkey, just to set the record
straight. Don't
even
go there. Betty, my wife Betty, is a modern dancer, choreographer, former. She's also taught in the public schools,
mm-hmm.
Which lasted longer than I wanted her to.
By the way, this interpretive dance performance, mm-hmm. this collaboration,
yeah.
is a good argument against the arts in schools.
Because the arts, you know why the left controls the Arts Council and why for years Michael Madigan was boss, never got really beat up by the arts community? Because his wife was in charge of the Arts Council.
Oh, yeah.
She paid, in other words, the state took care of Metaphor.
Dame Shirley, yes.
Wrapped Metaphor around Michael Madigan and protected him from that. Right. It's politics.
This is just amazing.
With this dance thing?
It's remarkable to me. It really is.
There's carjacking. Why don't they do?
We're beyond parody.
Why don't they do? We shut the schools down because we felt like it, and these kids are out on the street, and they're pistol whipping you in Lincoln Park, and they're not in school, and they're taking your car. Why don't you do a dance to that?
By the way, related story, serious note, New York Times reporting, surge of student suicides pushes Las Vegas schools to reopen. Since schools shut their doors in March, an early warning system that monitors students' mental health episodes has sent more than 3,100 alerts to district officials, raising alarms about suicidal thoughts, possible self-harm, or cries for care. By December, 18 students in Vegas school system had taken their own lives. This was in part the reason the school board green-lighted the reopening. Of course, we had this very difficult but important conversation with Chris Buckner on Friday's show. Chris Buckner, the father of Dylan Buckner, the Glenbrook North standout quarterback as well as student who committed suicide. And you see... all these schools that are hybrid or full in person. By the way, it's like 60% of private schools to 5% of public schools during the pandemic had at least some in-person learning. This should be a conversation about how we do schooling in America. That's really what the last 10 months should precipitate. I'm not sure it will, but maybe the continued... to continue with the theme, the continued Orwellian policies will, and I take you to Park Ridge, Niles, District 64. We talked about the lanyards. We've had some people call in, too, about at their school, it's lanyards that designate the parent checked, or it's saliva tests even to get into the building. And Rick Biagi in Park Ridge asked a good question in response to the superintendent in Park Ridge. As students are going to the building, it's a very quick, easy thing for staff members to see their lanyards so we can keep the lines moving. But one of the concerns is, will the lanyard potentially turn into some type of tracking device? Biagi, also, who's a board member, asked about the possibility of student lanyards containing more personal information in the future of whether the student has received the vaccine. To whether their parents keep guns in the home. Is this the beginning of the slippery slope, he asked.
Why don't you just chip them? Put a chip in their hand.
Well, I mean, these are the questions that should be asked right now.
It could only be entertained in a culture that has given up on liberty.
Yes, safety for liberty.
Right.
Or frankly, the perception of safety.
That's the
delusion of safety.
Delusion of safety, right, the fantasy of safety. But it's also, to me, all this that you're talking about, from the dance, the CTU modern dance and all mm-hmm. that nonsense, mm-hmm. to what you talked about last week with respect to the woke instruction, the demand by the state that teachers not only give woke political instruction, but also judging teachers based on how much they cleave to the party line.
Well, that's the whole. That's what's pending at the state level here. Right. The culturally responsive teaching methods edict from the Illinois State Board of Education.
And that's all an argument for one thing, as far as I'm concerned: complete and total school choice.
Well, for
if
sure.
you care about your communities, if you care about your families, you will argue for school choice, because that's you can't defeat this hydra by chopping heads off and putting. Torches on the stump of the neck. It'll just keep going.
David and McCook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey, Dan, did I hear you say you enjoy ballet a few minutes ago?
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
I'm an occasional attendee of
Joffrey performance, yes, sure.
I am placing your man card under a 30-day suspension, please.
All right, David, thanks. I did like the performative dance because it called to mind some of the other great dance scenes, like Hot Rod from the Hot Rod, Andy Samberg movie.
Mm.
You may not. How about Top Secret, the ballet scene in Top Secret? Did you ever see that?
No. Sorry.
It's very good.
I do remember watching Tom Cruise dancing to something while he was...
Risky Business?
Risky Business, yeah. In his little tight.
You never saw Top Secret?
Yeah, I think
Val Kilmer?
Yeah, I think I did, yeah.
The ballet scene is memorable.
I'm not really into comedy. I'm more into, if you want me to laugh, you'll hit, like Barry Lyndon, to me, was hilarious, okay? Something by Thackeray with a little, sort of like, sounds like Dan Proft narrating it, but in another century.
Oh, brother. All right.
Yeah.
Mary Kay in Western Springs.
By the way, Mary Kay, do we know each other? Because I lived in Western Springs for years. Do we
know? I know.
Do we?
Well, we don't. We met at the train a couple of times. I think I just saw you smoking a cigarette, getting ready for the train. But
smoking a cigarette, that doesn't sound. Like
I miss you, John. I wish you.
I miss it out it there. Yeah.
Did you quit yet? The thing with the train.
What
was
are you
nice
talking
once
about
in a while,
now?
But...
Stop it.
No, it's just the way I talk to my husband too. What are the teachers? What a bunch of selfish jerks. You know, I'm just so tired of listening to them not want to work and always saying, it's all about the kids. It's all about the kids. Like you say, Dan, it's like it's not about the kids. It's proof what's happened over the last 10 months that it's not about the kids. It's just not. Defying the order to go back to work, fire them. That's all I can say. Fire these people. Why are they still teaching?
You think she will?
Oh, my gosh. They're negotiating from a position of weakness right now. They're trying to offer a surrender while still saving face. That's what they're doing. That's what the city is doing
dance.
Right now.
Let's dance, Dan. Let's get up there and dance. Come on.
Everybody's
we'll
dancing
dance
on their way out of city and state, right. Mary Kay.
Thanks for the call,
we're
Mary
all dancing on the way to Georgia or Tennessee.
Mary Kay, John, and I will dance it out.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. John Cash, Chicago Tribune columnist extraordinaire, and press conference this morning in Chicago, 10 a.m. The two brothers who've accused father, in quotation marks, Michael Flager, of sexually molesting them for years. The two are brothers, it turns out. In advance of this morning's press conference, which apparently you'll hear from the accusers and their attorney, Dana Kozlov at CBS2 Chicago had them on, did not disclose their identities. All we know is they're brothers. And this was...
Were they adopted?
What they had to say. Not disclosed. Don't know.
I was embarrassed. I was to the point that I couldn't forgive myself because I blamed myself all these years.
It's a younger brother.
Take us to different pizza parlors throughout the city of Chicago. That was my first time ever going to an amusement park.
The older brother says he saw Flager as a father figure.
I would describe my case as a kid looking for someone who cared about him. And I think he took that angle, and I felt he made me feel a little bit special. I don't describe it as forceful in any way. It was kind of a slow grooming process.
The younger brother saying that the abuse started for him at age 13. And here's what they have to say about Flager.
I would like people to know there is a dark side to Mike Flager.
I want to say this to the people who are still questioning this. All the good that he's done for the African-American community, I'm not taking away from that. But he also pilfered the African-American community by preying on African-American kids.
And so,
my God.
By the way, maybe one of these venerable journalists, in quotation marks, in Chicago, would raise, by the way, who were responsible co-conspirators in conferring this guy's status for decades. Maybe they would like to, and I know they know this like I do, maybe they would like to go ask the esteemed Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice Ann Burke about her flacking for Flager for all the years that she did. Ann Burke, for those who don't know, was a heavy in the Catholic community on behalf of Flager. For people like me who found this demagogic creep to be just that for decades, and very few people in positions of amplification listened, because of course he was prosecuting their political agenda. He's the anti-Catholic Catholic, and that's what the media likes to cover. This is an opportunity maybe to do a little penance and bring some people along. There's I know some swirl going on in Catholic circles that suggests that these two brothers who came forward is just the beginning. And obviously I wouldn't be surprised, because the church in this city, the archdiocese, and the political media establishment gave Flager free reign for generations.
I'm not one of those who was a cheerleader for Father Mike, but I, first of all, after hearing that, it's heartbreaking. And I think Father Mike deserves, if not the benefit of the doubt, and also a pause here. When someone is accused of something so terrible, I want to hear from them. I want them to speak out. And I'd give him the microphone, the notebook, the pad, whatever. I want to hear from him.
Flager, you mean?
Yes, I do.
I bet you never do. He's gone.
I also think that there's things in Father Mike's life that are important. His advocacy for people that did not have a voice is important. But also, our complicit, I don't know, I'm not saying that we're conspirators, but the complicity of institutional establishment media always looking for someone to translate the black experience in an easy soundbite.
Sure.
We did that.
Why not go to the Catholic priest who looks like an Archie cartoon?
We did that with Reverend Jesse Jackson, who I called the King of Beers.
Mm-hmm.
We've done it with...
Not a reverend.
We don't do it with Farrakhan, who's a raging anti-Semite and hater. But we do it with others, including Father Flager, who's not black.
Right.
Why do we want someone else to say something that you could just knock on the door, knock on someone's home, knock on their front door and say, hey, can we talk? You don't need an urban translator. You know, that's another aspect of this. It's troubling. But the most troubling of all is to hear these men recount predation.
And they are,
makes me ill.
They are 63 and 61 years old, respectively, now. The abuse, they said, started 50 years ago, as we heard when this first allegation came out,
that's
50 years old. Well, those are all questions that need to be asked and need to be answered. And I can't agree with you, though, that he gave voice to the voiceless. I think he was Elmer Gantry.
Perhaps, but I give you, listen.
And I'm not going after you. I'm just saying,
no, I think
this guy was like all of these power centers in Chicago for the last 50 years, almost without exception. He was a predator. And I don't even mean that. I'm not condemning him to guilt with these accusations. I'll give him the, you know, innocent until proven guilty, right, just like anybody else. But he was a predator. He was a political predator. Maybe he was more than that, even a predator in other ways, even more disgusting ways. And so this raises a larger question. Now that so many of our heroes, John, in Chicago have fallen, Madigan, Burke, the Civic Fed CEOs, the old media outlets, they're all, Flager as the representative, right, of the church, they're all going away. Well, they're all going away. And so who charts Chicago's future, and what does it look like?
First of all, I've never been part of that group.
I know that.
You know that. And actually, for those of you listening, the two of the people most reviled by all of them, Republicans and Democrats among them, is Dan Proft and me. Okay? So we're PNG. But what happened?
I've grown to enjoy the antipathy that is directed my way. I really have. I mean, I think it, you know, since all cliches are true, and the people that despise you say a lot about you, as do the people that like you.
And they say a lot about themselves in their, as they try to keep you silent or heap invective upon you. But the larger question, what does this say about Chicago? It says that we've been corrupt ever since Jean-Baptiste du Sable. Did he sell whiskey to the Indians? I don't know. Did he give whiskey to the Indians? I don't know. I know that he's canonized now.
Well, I don't want to have to rename a bridge. I mean, we got enough renaming going on.
Columbus Drive. But if you look at it, this unholy marriage that I've talked about and written about for years, and that you've also talked about, the Republican, nominally, oligarchs of the city, cutting a deal with the machine Democrats in the city, reminiscent of sort of the corrupt arrangements between the equestrians and the Roman equestrians and an organized crime back in ancient Rome for control over the wharfs, etc., is a destructive thing. And I think a lot of this has to do with that relationship, that power relationship that set Chicago and Illinois on a course that now you can see the result, and people fleeing in droves.
But so does the combine. I mean, you know, the line from Boss that we both love, the short-lived series with Kelsey Grammer as the mayor of Chicago, which is change on the outside to protect continuity on the inside. You know, the facade of change when it was really a perpetuation of what was. But it seems to me that we might be at a break here, and that you don't have a bipartisan combine anymore, because all of those combine players have been marginalized or are gone, literally. And so what you have instead is something like we have on the streets of Chicago. Everybody is just a freelancing barbarian. There's nothing organized about it. It's just warlordocracy. It's, you know,
you've got the CTU warlords.
Yeah.
They're exerting their will on the children and the taxpayers. You've got the street gangs slaughtering each other and in street gang wars that some of us in journalism call gun violence.
Right.
Right, because if you call it street gang wars, Dan,
that
then you've got to do something about it.
Well, it also implicates that the people are involved,
right,
as opposed to just guns.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're pushing towards no cash bail for felons. So are you surprised that what we're seeing basically is like a dystopian novel?
I'm not, but play it forward here.
Yeah.
You know, Book of Eli, play it forward here. I don't see the people with titles who the press still goes to as if they matter, as if they are power centers, as right, power centers. The mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, is not a power center.
Not now.
I don't see, as I said, most of these C-suite types, there's a few, but I don't see most of them from a bygone era as still relevant. I don't see, CTU controls that system. But you know what? Unfortunately, here's the reality. 85% of the kids in CPS are on free or reduced school lunch. These are poor, disproportionately minority families. Mm-hmm. And that's what CTU controls. But that's all they control, because the wealthier people across the racial spectrum are out. They're gone. And they basically just, people have just washed their hands of it. So you go ahead and control it. I'm done with it. I'm not going to fight it.
Right.
That's your piece of turf. So there isn't a power center. There's nothing that's driving a future for Chicago. So it turns into what, Fury Road?
And we don't have any. We don't have on some rocky islands the Irish monks to save civilization here.
Yeah, that's
what we
right.
have. What we yeah, have
nice
is
Book of Eli closed.
Right, we have what we have are bands of warlords as like in the Dark Ages. Okay, after the fall of Rome and the fall of as Constantinople was still strong.
So I mean, this is my point. We don't have the
infrastructure to provide for what you were talking about. What we were talking about is deteriorating before our eyes.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So rather than change on the outside to continue on the inside,
right,
the appearance of change. Mm. No, what we have now is just the appearance of civilization, right? I mean, you just like Michigan Avenue is a Potemkin village.
Scarecrow cops, right? There's blue lights flashing on the squad cars. No cops inside. Just talked to Eddie Johnson about that. All that is going on,
right?
Carjackings.
Well, and we'll take your calls in just a second, but just because you had this chat with Eddie Johnson for your podcast, you wrote a column about it too that people should read. Here's somebody who's got three decades, whatever his mistakes,
right,
he's got three decades on the force, so he has some historical perspective. And what does he say?
The mistakes.
Yeah,
I asked him if the mayor has lost the city, and he wouldn't go that far, but he did say that people don't feel safe, and you can't have a city without people feeling safe.
So he said the mayor's lost the city, and
he did not say
in not so many in so many words. He basically
did not say those terms, but they're look. She fought. She decided to give to play ball with the CTU, toss them billions of dollars worth of cash, and go to war with the cops because it fit her politics. She embraced.
Why not? That's what Tiny Dancer did before.
Yeah, and she embraced endorsed Kim Fox, and she knows better. I know she knows better, and I've defended her from people like you, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
But it's getting to the point now where I don't see. And on top of it all, COVID allows for the management of news so that the governor can have a news conference or the mayor, and there's not repeated, constant badgering or questioning from Fran Spielman, John Cass, Bill Cameron, people like that in the building going, what did you mean by that? What did you say? None of that. It's all managed.
But don't worry.
What they do is they come out and say,
yeah,
we'll give you tips on how to deal with a carjacker.
Yeah, right. Yeah. First, curse yourself for living in Chicago. That's tip number one. Here's the other thing, though, is everything's fine because restaurants are 25% open.
Yeah.
Restaurants have 25% capacity, so everything's fine.
Who says it's fine? Who says that's fine?
Even
morons, idiots. Who says that it's fine? Are the taxes and fees only 25%? No.
Well.
So what are you talking about? I'm talking about people in my business and others prattling on, particularly on broadcast. Oh, the restaurants are open. We can go have our buttered fried chicken now. Shut the bleep up, moron.
Well, that's the other thing, too.
You don't know anything about business.
The other thing that's happening, what else is going away? The
jobs.
The vibrancy of the business community, the jobs.
800,000.
The cultural institutions. Sean from Elmwood Park.
And the people with an IQ over 60. Here's the other
Can I have a cigar?
You can, and you're going to pay for it. But I want to correct you. I love both of you, and you know I do. He's not an advocate. I'm talking about Flager. He's not an advocate for any particular community. What he's doing is the equivalent of what I did in the 80s when I strapped on my Z Cavaricci's and walked in Daddy Rockets. He's peacocking. He's auditioning. It serves 2 points. It serves
That's
two things. Number
on
one,
levels.
It gets the attention.
Image. Yeah.
It gets the attention of the of the community, right? And it scares the kids he's abusing because he has that attention.
Mm. He hasn't
he's
been
a scumbag. Come on, John. You can't look at him smarmy. You can't look at that smarmy son of a gun and see something's wrong.
Sean, people say bad stuff about everybody. We have to.
John,
I'm
I understand,
sorry.
And you're a wonderful you're a wonderful man.
Look,
and I understand.
You want me to lecture you both on Saint Nectarios?
No, look,
I can't because you're both heretics as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks for the call. Look, let's to take Sean's perspective is if he is guilty of what he is accused of doing, then this was what he was doing. I think there's a point there, actually.
Yes, there is. The peacocking thing. I'll tell you, one of the first times I met Father Flager, Copper from Harold Washington's detail was banished to guard Father Flager, a good guy. Okay, he was a top copper, street cop. And he had to guard Father Flager. It was raining, and he was making headlines nationally about buying crack pipes in the city and holding news conferences. And so this kid, this deacon or something, in a pouring rain, had to stand there in the rain screaming to Father Flager, "Father Flager, you made Time Magazine!" And I look at the cop for buying crack pipes. And I look at the copper and he's like, "Father Flager just saved us from crack." It was perfect.
Yeah. The problem in Chicago, I guess, is that we've always loved charlatans, regardless of the civic or political posts that they hold. And when you pile up enough charlatans, boy, you pile up the detritus, and that's what we've done in this city.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the things, and for Amy, I should mention, because you won't recognize the voice, or Amy's got a terrible cold.
No, it's of nature.
No, it's a nice impersonation. It's the Chicago Tribune columnist extraordinaire John Cass in for Amy J this morning.
Thanks, Dan, for having me.
Of course, our pleasure, of course, as always. And one of the things that Biden spoke of at his inaugural address, you'll recall, was how he's going to restore America's standing in the world, rebuild our relationships with our allies. How's that going? Here's Alberta Premier Jason Kenney on Biden's peremptory cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline.
The biggest part of that trade is Canadian energy exports, largely from our province here of Alberta. We have the third largest oil reserves in the world. We ship about nearly $100 billion worth of energy to the U.S. every year. Keystone XL would have been a significant, safe, modern increase in that shipment. And it is very it's very frustrating that one of the first acts of the new president was, I think, to disrespect America's closest friend and ally, Canada, to kill good-paying union jobs on both sides of the border, and ultimately to make the United States more dependent on foreign oil imports from OPEC dictatorships. We don't understand it, and at the very least, we believe that those who've invested in this project, trusting in the regulatory process in the U.S., should be compensated by the U.S. administration.
You mean the taxpayers?
Oh, off to a slow start in terms of, feeling the era of good feelings with our allies, including our neighbors to the Great White North. We'll start there with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be with you.
So what about that? Disrespectful to the Canadians. That's not the lovey-doveyness we expected from that we expected the Biden administration to bring to the world.
Well, you know, it's more than that. It's bad science. It's bad economics. It is bad foreign policy, and it's actually anti-truth. So it's almost a poster child for all the things the Biden administration promised they weren't going to be. It is really bad science. So we have a pipeline that's about a half a billion barrels. So the XL would have doubled that moving. That oil's still probably going to come to the United States because that's the most efficient place to take it. It's going to come in tankers, which means that the CO2 emissions will be infinitely greater. So it's actually bad. It's a bad decision for the environment. It makes terrible economics. All you're doing is, because oil is a fungible global commodity, if you make Canadian American energy more expensive, all that means is you're making, you know, people like Russia and Venezuela's energy cheaper, and you're making people more dependent on less reliable sources of energy. It's, of course, terrible foreign policy. And the reality is, it's a policy that's not good for the environment or for energy. So it really only pleases the most progressive, radical environmental activists who think that if we just cut off all the sources of oil and gas, that's how we're going to make the transition to green energy. When even the people that really endorse the transition to green energy argue that you have to have a transition between fossil fuels and green energy, and things like the XL pipeline actually facilitate that transition. So it's hard to, I mean, I don't know why they did this, because they didn't explain it, which apparently was, I guess, not part of being bipartisan and being president for all Americans. They just did it. But it seems hard to find any other explanation that this is just a policy to please the most radical environmental activists.
There's one more kicker to this, too, which is a Native American tribe in Utah sent a pretty angry letter to the Department of Interior, not about Keystone XL specifically, but about the executive order that temporarily halts leases and permits for energy development on federal land. So now he can't even keep, some of what ostensibly would be his constituents, you know, playing woke politics, identity politics. He's got a Utah Native American tribe not too pleased with him on this energy policy gambit as well.
But you guys missed something.
You know,
you both missed something.
You know, here's
where's ahead, the lieutenant. Where's Lieutenant Colonel? Where is the railroad industry? They've got to be happy with this.
So Warren Buffett's happy.
Warren Buffett and anybody investing in tankers, right? Tanker cars.
Right, but they would be, because they're going to make more money, but it's not nearly as efficient and cost-effective, and it actually increases greenhouse gases. So it's because eventually, if you do railroads, you still got to transit that to a tanker at some point, and the transit times are going to be longer from the railroads than they would be from a pipeline. So, you know, I think the biggest issue here from an environmental and energy policy standpoint is how do you make a transition to greener energies? And the answer is, you make energy more affordable, you make economies more wealthy and more efficient, and you facilitate the evolution of technology and infrastructure. All this does is it makes us poorer and more vulnerable. It's a terrible, terrible policy decision.
Well, and on the score of energy independence and economic vitality, those two scores, I suppose, the news over the weekend that China has now taken over the United States as the world's top destination for new foreign direct investment. They did that last year, now supplanting the United States as the most attractive place for capital to locate. What are the implications of that?
Well, I think the problem is the more investment there is in China from foreign companies, and the more companies are in such entangled with China, the more dependent they are on them, and the more dominant China's position is technology. But they aren't secret about this. I actually wrote a book about this back in, I think, 2006 or something, and I went back and looked at it, where And the Chinese said, you know, over a decade ago, their goal is information dominance, and they're going to achieve that through dominating digital and other forms of infrastructure. They look at information as kind of the world's new nuclear weapons, and facilitating and speeding that process of Chinese dominance actually definitely puts the United States in a more vulnerable position long term. And the only way to, here's the deal, the only way to really compete with that is to make the American economy more attractive to invest in. Things like making energy in America more expensive, that does the exact opposite of making America an attractive destination for foreign investment.
Let's talk about that just for a second longer, because I was referred to a development economist named Albert Hirschman, who wrote this interesting perspective on Germany in the run-up to World War II. And he wrote in 1941 that Germany was neither a free trader nor a protectionist. It was a power trader. Used trade as a key to gain commercial and military advantage over its adversaries. And the argument is that's what China is doing. It's not free trade or protectionism. We're looking at it the wrong way. It's power trading to gain commercial or military advantages. So it's sort of individually specific. It's context specific. But the play is power. It is not ideological in terms of free trade to grow the economy versus protectionism to protect industries. That's not what they're doing.
I think that's an accurate, you know, I have a PhD in history. That's, I think, an accurate both economic and historical assessment. And you know, in the end, the United States was able to dominate in World War II simply because we had the world's most innovative, free, and powerful economy. And the policies that are not building on the strengths of our economy, like making us more energy dependent, making energy more expensive, limiting companies' abilities to innovate and grow, not challenging China. You don't want a level playing field with China in great power competition. The early mark of the Biden policies is that's exactly what it looks like they're trying to do.
No great power ever wants a level playing field. Correct?
Well, I mean, if you're a great power that isn't threatened by others, you're perfectly happy to tolerate that, and indeed you value that because you know a rising tide lifts all boats. That is not China's approach to the world. And what frustrates me is this: the Chinese have been very upfront and public about this. They've stated what their goal in the world is, and one of their goals in the world is to diminish America's presence as a force in the world. You know, fundamentally, the United States and other countries like us, we believe in free markets, we believe in freely elected governments, and we believe in the free enterprise system. The Chinese Communist Party doesn't believe in any of that, and their goal in the world is they see those as obstacles to the expansion of their power and influence is to diminish those things. So the way you compete with the Chinese is not by self-diminishing your own strengths. And I think a short-sighted environmental policy is the perfect way to diminish America's ability to not just stand for America, but to stand for the equities that make free society strong and resilient.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP at the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you there, John.
Thank you, Jim.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Chicago Tribune's John Cass in for Amy J. this morning. Take a call or two in reaction to our confab with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, mainly about China, but also about Keystone XL. Steve and Huntley, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. I love your back and forth you guys do. Hey, just a thought on that XL pipeline. I heard that one of the main beneficiaries of the XL pipeline is Warren Buffett, who gave the most for the elections because he keeps all that oil on his train set. But, hey, wasn't President Biden just excoriated for being this despot dictator for all of the executive orders he did? Is anyone doing a comparison on what President Trump's executive orders were and President Biden's, I hate saying that, executive star. Is anyone doing a comparison on that?
Thanks for the call, Steve. There's a good op-ed over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal. Biden all of a sudden loves Brett Kavanaugh because he's embracing the theory or the concept of the unitary executive that Kavanaugh is essentially a proponent of in some of his legal writings. So, yes, there's no question. But remember, with respect to the intelligentsia, their hypocrisy is emblematic of their status. They get to be hypocrites because there are betters. And that's how they actually think.
They think that way, but they don't rise unless they play ball, which is true in Washington and for the most part in any major city, including Chicago.
It's been true ever since Shakespeare wrote it in Measure for Measure, some by vice do rise and others by virtue fall, John Cass.
Very good, my friend.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning, Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass. And John, Megyn Kelly made a little news over the weekend in a BBC interview. Maybe she's trying to get back in good with Fox or news reestablish man. A brand or something. I don't know. But this is what she had to say about the D.C. press corps and what happened on January 6th. Take a listen.
They hated him so much, they checked their objectivity. And it wasn't just CNN. All of them did. They just couldn't check their own personal feelings about him. Either that or they signed on to what I call the Jorge Ramos theory of covering Trump. He was at Univision, and he advocated prior to Trump's election that we needed to cover him differently, that you needed to outwardly call him a racist, sexist, misogynist, all of it, and that was important for history. And I think too many journalists agreed with that at their own peril. That part of the reason we saw what happened on the Capitol here 2 weeks ago was because there's been a complete lack of trust, destruction of trust in the media, and people don't know where to turn for true information.
Almost a suggestion that the D.C. press corps coverage was, I don't want to say incited, but was impactful in terms of people's frustration, some people's frustrations boiling over to the point of lawlessness.
She's playing a game here. Look, nobody, if you attack the Capitol, you broke the law, there's no excuse for it, okay?
Agreed.
There's no excuse. The larger story, I think she's kind of missing it, is that when you have no trust in our institutions, media is just an institution. For 40 years, the hard left has been about deconstructing objective truth and saying it's all your truth or your own truth, and let's speak about narrative because narrative is their new religion. And all of this is destructive in the long term, as we can see.
Yeah, and Matt Taibbi writes about this a bit at his blog at Substack, and he the trust in media is an all-time low, and that's just dismissed as, well, that's because conservatives dislike the traditional media. But that's true, but it's not the whole story. 18% of Republicans reported reported trusting media, according to an Axios story and the survey that they referenced. But 57% of Democrats trust the media. And Taibbi writes, 57% of half your potential audience is nothing to brag about when you're in the trust business, right? That actually turns out to be a problem, too, even despite the disparity between Republicans and Democrats on the trust question. For more on this and a couple of other matters, we're pleased to be joined by David Marcus, New York correspondent for The Federalist, Federalist.com, contributor to The New York Post as well. David, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
What about that, speaking as a member of the press corps, but not probably one that's welcome to in those circles that we're discussing? What about what sort of the combination of Megyn Kelly and Taibbi is saying about the state of media?
I mean, I don't want to speak for John, but I mean, I don't trust this. I'm sympathetic to what Megyn said. because I do think that there were a lot of factors, and I do think that I want to associate myself with John's statement that there was absolutely no excuse for the horrible actions at the U.S. Capitol. But I didn't imagine a federal courthouse in Portland being under siege for a month.
There you go, right? Dave. What about ism?
It's not. Well, you know what? The problem with the concept of whataboutism is that it's usually uttered by people who are trying to defend their own hypocrisy. So it's true,
exactly.
Right? These things happened, and I don't know if I had been in that situation in the Capitol, having looked at what happened all summer, I might have thought to myself, well, I've been watching this happen all summer, and CNN says it's peaceful. So that's not an excuse, but I do think that Megan's condemnation of the media is warranted. I think Taibbi is right as well. It's just amazing to me. You know, I wrote a column this morning about the situation where the New York Times had fired an editor purportedly for sending a tweet that said she got chills seeing Joe Biden. Now, they say it's deeper than that, but that seems to have been what triggered the firing. And the point that I made is the problem isn't any individual at the New York Times. The problem is the New York Times. They don't tell the truth. And they have bias, right? They pretend they don't have bias, but it's very clear that they do. And the American people aren't stupid. And I think that's the biggest issue, is that the media, the politicians, the elites in general really do think that the American people are stupid, right? We had the state of California say just the other day, well, we're not releasing the coronavirus data because it could be misinterpreted by
right.
the people.
That's right.
It might mislead them. Well, who are you to do that? I'm not your child.
How different is that than Tony Fauci telling the New York Times, you know, I'm going to parcel out what I think is the threshold number for herd immunity as I think the American people can handle it.
It's exactly the same. And I'm free to do that with my 10-year-old son. I don't tend to, right? Because even my 10-year-old son, I would prefer in general to know the truth about things. But the state of California and Tony Fauci and the New York Times ought not be doing that in regard to the American people.
Well, and one other thing, too, just on this, you know, going back to how the unrest and the violence throughout America was treated over the summer into the fall, into the present. Andy Ngo, who has been Johnny on the spot in Portland for the last mm-hmm. year and Seattle and elsewhere, and documenting Antifa, since some members of Antifa almost killed him last summer. The Antifa rioting that was going on in Portland and Seattle, Twitter didn't do anything to stop the planning of that was happening online with those Twitter accounts, too. So it's not even looking retrospectively. It's watching in real time as there is one standard applied here and another standard applied there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what it feels like more than anything else is a social credit system. Senator Josh Hawley has the cover story of today's New York Post writing about this very thing, that these corporations now are going to monitor your beliefs, are going to monitor your ideology, and that'll determine whether you can have a hotel room. That'll determine whether you can get on a plane. It's very scary stuff. And the left will stand on their soapbox and say, this isn't censorship because it's not the government. Well, that's nonsense. Censorship is censorship. It doesn't matter if this is coming from the government or this is coming from, you know, these gigantic corporations. The result is the same.
David, what happened, referencing your piece this morning, why the New York Times was wrong to fire Lauren Wolf. What happened to civil libertarians in the Democratic Party? I wrote about this last week. The people that are editors, publishers, teachers, professors, who welcomed diverse views and intellectual combat. What happened to them?
I don't have a great answer for that. I think there are a few things that happened. I mean, you know, we came up with the idea of an American left that said, I abhor your views, but I will defend your right to express them.
Right. Right? That was the mistaken attribution to Voltaire. Right.
Yes. That was sort of the classic line. That went out the window. I think it has something to do with this notion of corporate wokeism. I don't want to go too deep in the weeds, but I recently reread Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent, right? And he's a big lefty. And he wrote this at the end of the 1980s about how corporations and those in power control the media and they censor and stuff. I think what Chomsky couldn't imagine is that corporate America would turn so hard to the left. And I think they see an opportunity here to silence their critics. And I think they're taking the opportunity that's given and abandoning what had been their first principle. But you're right. It's a massive change.
And I'm not, and despite the fact you invoke Noam Chomsky, I'm not going to make you define what an anarcho-syndicalist is. So it's just too early for that. I wanted to get to this other piece that you wrote about Mitch McConnell, him needing to go. It's very interesting what's happened in GOP ranks and get your perspective on it. You had Liz Cheney be censured by one county party in Wyoming and facing at least one primary opponent already. Arizona Republicans moved to censure both Cindy McCain and Governor Doug Ducey. But meanwhile, you have Mitt Romney saying if we're going to have unity, there must be accountability. And he means accountability in the form of convicting the president of dereliction of duty, as it were. It's interesting that Romney wants accountability there, but not for the expert class and all of everything that they have gotten wrong, catastrophically so, across the spectrum, or done perhaps unethically, if not illegally, in places like the FBI and CIA. But nonetheless, accountability is Mitt Romney's watchword. And you have some Republican parties attaching accountability to their home state Republicans. And Mitch McConnell seeming to be in liege with Mitt Romney, at least rhetorically to this point. It looks like potentially we're headed for a real schism, one that's even deeper and wider than it is at present.
Yeah, look, I think McConnell and Cheney and Romney are all making the same mistake. And it's a mistake also that unfortunately a lot of conservative journalists are making, which is that they really think that support for Donald Trump was based solely on this cult of personality, right? And McConnell's been clear that he wants to sort of excise Trump from the party. What they don't understand is that it's not about the individual person, Donald Trump. It's about a whole host of issues having to do, you know, everything from trade to immigration to not getting into new foreign wars. I mean, There's a whole platform of issues where he really transformed the party. And the voters aren't going to go back to the 30 years that they had of, you know, elite GOP politicians saying, we don't share your values, we don't share your beliefs, we don't put you first, but we're better than Democrats, so you have no choice. Trump proved that they do have a choice. McConnell saw an opportunity here to shame those voters into getting back on the old establishment GOP farm. And thus far, the voters are saying, no, we won't. And that's why McConnell apparently can't muster the votes to convict the president. And that's going to put a lot of egg on his face because, you know, the old saying, you shoot at the king, you better not miss.
Isn't part of this also McConnell's effort to corral, I think you even mentioned it in your piece, Mitch McConnell needs to go, to corral Hawley, Cruz, and others, you know, can't anyone rid me of these cursed conservatives?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, but you know, it's Hawley who's got the word of the New York Post today, not Mitch McConnell. So you know, these are the voices of the future. Mitch McConnell is very much the voice of the past, and you know, we thank him for his service, and we got a lot of judges, which is great. But let's not forget this: he'll go down in history for the Merrick Garland gambit, right? Because that really could have backfired. Why didn't it backfire? It didn't backfire because Trump won the election.
Right.
Well, the thing that's curious about Mitch McConnell, I mean, how does, you know, because if he's just a political animal and he just wants to be Senate Majority Leader, then how does pursuing this path set him and set the Republicans up to retake control of the Senate, much less the House, in 2022? I just don't see how one leads to the other in his mind.
Everybody is confused by this, right? Like, the people that I've talked to in D.C., you know, who had the ear of senators, you know, people like Rick Scott, you know, just sort of like reasonable, normal Republican senators, really do not understand what McConnell's doing here or why. I can't get in his head, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them.
He is David Marcus, New York correspondent for The Federalist, Federalist.com, contributed to New York Post as well. David, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great day, guys.
Take care. See you, Dave. And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Dr. Deborah Birx sat down with Margaret Brennan at Face the Nation yesterday for a extended interview. And the parts that the D.C. press corps pick out to amplify are not the most interesting parts. And point of fact, I think the most interesting tell from Deborah Birx's Q&A was this little bit from talking about how things developed from March and April, the, you know, 2 weeks to flatten the curve, to the lockdowns that started, and then the over the summer, some of the states starting to break with the orthodoxy and begin to open up. Take a listen.
I think the White House personnel were very focused on this pandemic in March and April. I think once the country began to open, and it was clear to me that they weren't going to follow my really gating criteria that I had worked hard on.
How to open restaurants, how to let people dine
indoors. I combined all of that together for these great gating criteria. So in calculating everything with the slow reopening, I didn't think anyone could get to phase three until August. And you can see in the states that followed either that criteria or a similar criteria, that's how long it took them.
Yeah, right. I worked so hard, Dr. Jill Biden. I worked so hard on the gating criteria to come up with the answer, you know, me being the Oracle of Delphi, that then should be distributed to all the governors to follow with specificity. This is so interesting because this is the folly of the expert class, particularly in retrospect. Barton Swaim had an excellent piece in The Wall Street Journal over the weekend about Trump and the failure of said expert class. And on COVID, he wrote in part, "We are still in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, so it's difficult to write about it with the perspective it demands. Yet political talking points aside, this much is apparent. No nation, or anyhow, no nation that values individual liberty and isn't an island, has managed even to slow the spread of COVID-19 without causing economic ruin and attendant disorder." This is not to say that he has no criticisms of the Trump administration decision-making and communication. He does, and they're, I think, largely on point. But he goes on to say, "The outstanding failure of the 2020 pandemic was the experts' belief that only the only sensible response involved Deborah Birx's gating criteria, sustained closures of businesses and schools. By any set of criteria outside the self-contained system of public health best practices, the lockdowns failed. They purchased minor slowdowns in the spread of the virus at the cost of punishing economic destruction, untold social dysfunction, and mind-blowing public debt. The experts' failure." But there is no accountability for those failures. There is just the response of, well, they didn't follow the gating criteria. Well, this is a mutation. Well, we didn't do it big enough. Well, we're not getting enough cooperation. Well, somebody was seen in a position of authority not wearing a mask, and that's what we should all focus on, rather than the underlying policies across the board. inflicting exactly what Barton Swaim describes.
Dan, the I recommend to everyone who's listening to go back into your bookshelf, find Jonathan Swift, read about the island of Laputa, the floating island, consisting of an educated elite who are fond of mathematics, astronomy, technology, but fail to make practical use of their knowledge. How do you have a country that prizes liberty while you're ratcheting down liberty? How do you do that, given the human failures of policymakers like Gavin Newsom, like Ms. Birx herself, Dr. Birx herself?
There's something else going on here, too, and I think Theodore Dalrymple gets to it in a good piece that he wrote for Law and Liberty. LawLiberty.org is the site. So let's get to Theodore Dalrymple to have him explain. Theodore Dalrymple, contributing editor of City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and author of False Positive, A Year of Error, Omission, and Political Correctness in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'll start there and then go back and read all of Theodore Dalrymple's oeuvre, I would highly recommend. Theodore Dalrymple, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for asking me.
You write in your piece about pandemic nightmares that one of the nightmare, or perhaps one of the bases of the nightmares, is this imperative that the state believes it has to appear to be doing something, even if it's not doing it, and in this case, saving lives.
Yes, well, obviously the politician, for the first time in my life, I have some sympathy for the politicians because they're going to get it in the neck, whatever they do. And they can't be seen to be not doing anything when people are dying. So they have to do something. And, of course, I live in Europe and the regulations are different in every country in Europe, and there isn't really justification for many of them, or at least no public justification of them.
Well, but one of the things that some politicians did early and some are doing now is to say, you know, here's what we know and here's what we're trying to figure out. And one of the things that we know is we can't bend nature to our will, and we have to try to achieve a balanced approach based on the best, albeit imperfect, information we have. We need to learn to live with this as we've lived with other viral outbreaks in human history. That's what some politicians, a few, said and have been consistent in opposing these strict cookie-cutter lockdowns, while others now who were supporters of those strict cookie-cutter lockdowns, I'm thinking of the governor of New York, the mayor of Chicago, now we're coming around to the reality of the human condition that we do need to learn to live with these things if you want to live in a free society and combat them in a way that takes trade-offs into account.
Yes, well, the trouble is we don't take trade-offs into account, and the politicians have to look at the headlines and what is being said on social media and so on. So very few politicians who are in power at any rate from the beginning, said we have to trade off possibly deaths against the economic and social destruction. At least I don't know of any politicians in Europe who have said that. The nearest who've come to it are the Swedes, and they have in fact had more deaths than their near neighbours, Denmark, Finland, Norway, which are very comparable countries. But if, say, a British or a French politician said, well, we have to face the fact that people are going to die, but we can't just close the whole economy down because of that, I think there would be a terrible outcry.
Well, I mean, you know, just pick your outcry, I suppose. I wanted to get to one other premise here, get your assessment of this, particularly as a psychiatrist. Going back to Barton Swaim's piece in the Wall Street Journal that I was referencing, He writes, controlling the spread of COVID-19 in the U.S. was always going to be a messy business. Many infected people don't get sick and have no compelling reason to burrow in their homes. And America is an unruly nation with a long tradition of nonconformity. These experts might have accounted for these realities. Part of this is the suspension of disbelief, because not only do these politicians pretend they can bend nature to its will, that they believe they can change man, change the innate nature of man through state policy.
Yes, well, I mean, the fact is, of course, that it was clear from fairly early on that the vast majority of the population had relatively little, but very little really, to fear from this virus, and only certain groups had had something to fear, the very old, people like me, in fact. So, but they, the politicians felt they couldn't make different policies for different groups of people. I mean, as soon as anyone suggested that there would be a differential between the way, there should be a differential between the way very old people and young people are treated, were immediately accused of trying to institute apartheid, which, of course, is ridiculous, because the difference in the suggested way in which people were treated was based on real evidence and real dangers. But anyway, that is just one of the problems that the politicians face, that if they suggest such a thing, specific measures that affect some people much more than others, they're cried down.
Mr. Dalrymple, I'm a big fan, Doctor, and I wanted to ask you about the relationship between the fear of COVID and the desire to eliminate risk among many Americans and people of the West. Like, we must not risk one thing, one child, one person's death, and we'll trade our liberties for it. And the 9/11 catastrophe, terrorism attacks in New York of years ago, where we eagerly ran to give up our liberty to our central state. Please look at my phone. Please watch my every movements. Please read my email. What has happened to culture in these?
Well, as you point out, people are unwilling to risk anything, and in a way you can say this is, I'm not religious myself, but it's a decline in religious belief. And if you don't believe in any external meaning to life, then life is all you have and it must be saved at all costs. So you're, because after life there's nothing. And so saving life, especially your own life, but including lives of others, is the main aim of life. The longer the life, the better the life. But so any life that is cut short is ipso facto a terrible tragedy.
But you write in your piece, though, you know, that's sort of a self delusion or a rationalization, because those lives that the people believe they're saving, either if they're a politician instituting lockdown policies or if there's somebody wearing a mask and shaming their neighbors to do the same. In their daily lives, many of them, I mean, they don't really value those lives, those other lives. And in point of fact, they support all sorts of policies that devalue those lives, particularly as you go up the age demographic. So, I mean, part of this is all just performance art, and not just in the security measures, but in terms of the genuine concern for one's fellow man.
Yes, well, that is true. But we live in an age, one could say, it's an age of logocracy. So what you say is actually the most important aspect of your whole morality. And where that is the case, the content and the meaning are relatively unimportant. So we have people who are very virtuous in their words, but do nothing. And they are deemed good.
Oh, yes. Yes, no, there's no question about
virtue
that.
Signaling.
Again, leaning on your expertise in medicine as a psychiatrist, stories out the last week or so about school districts that are reopening in part because they're finally starting to get the message about how destructive keeping kids in relative isolation has been, both in terms of mental health as well as in terms of the worst outcomes, meaning suicides, not to mention the spike in opioid overdose deaths around the country. Again, headlines over the last several weeks. And I wonder how long you think that the tail might be with respect to the psychology of young people in particular, sort of school age, and of the culture in general. How long the safetyism and the people who are sort of addled by fear will last? Has this episode over the last year and ongoing, you know, fundamentally altered the course of Western civilization for some time to come?
Well, I can't quite make up my mind about this because, of course, people are capable of amnesia is a great force. So people are capable of forgetting things very quickly. And if you talk to the young in people who lived through 10 or 15 years of communism, they've forgotten about it already, and no one tells them about it. And the safetyism that you refer to, I mean, this is an extreme form of the safetyism there is, but there's a safetyism that preceded this. This just doesn't come out of nothing. I once counted on an escalator in Sydney, Australia, six warnings about how to go up an escalator safely.
Yes.
And unfortunately, they were all at the bottom, so I nearly fell off while I was trying to do.
Well, thank God you survived that escalator ride.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it was terribly dangerous, isn't it? There were people being made mincemeat of by this escalator. But luckily, some were saved by these notices. But anyway, the point is that there are hundreds of notices all over the place. I mean, you would think that going on a bus was incredibly dangerous from the notices on buses now and so on and so forth. And please read the safety instructions on trains and that kind of thing. Those messages we get. And on trains, please report if you see anything suspicious. Well, to me, most of the people on the train.
Yes.
So we live in an age in which people are supposed to be extremely safety conscious, although, of course, they are safer than any human beings have ever been in the whole of human history. But
except
I suppose
when they sit down to write. Except when they sit down to write. Right?
But I suppose fears grow. Fear is inversely proportional to its real causes or reason for fear.
All right. I'm going to leave it. I'm going to call that the Dalrymple equation. I like that. Theodore Dalrymple, contributing editor of City Journal, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and author of False Positive, A Year of Error, Omission, and Political Correctness in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Dalrymple, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
A great pleasure, doctor.
Yeah, I love the dry wit, as only the British can do. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The bad news for the D.C. press corps with respect to the Biden administration.
John, what?
He's going to put the fact checkers out of business because, as Glenn Kessler from the Amazon Post said over the weekend, you know, he expects that Joe Biden will tell the truth like Obama did. So there's no need for him anymore.
I assume the Biden, you know, I did 5 years of Obama, and I assume the Biden presidency will be a lot like the Obama presidency in that they will be responsive and will be able to quickly back up what they're saying. And occasionally the president will go off kilter, particularly when he's, you know, speaking extemporaneously and not following something that previously been fact-checked.
Oh, you mean that extemporaneous speaking about, hey, what Fast and Furious? I just read about it in the paper, just like you. Or, hey, what IRS? I just read about it in the paper, just like you. Really?
Or, hey, a video prompted a spontaneous riot in Benghazi. But I'll tell you, it's something to give confirmed plagiarist the benefit of the doubt of being a truth teller.
Does that apply to both the president and the real president, Kamala Harris?
I mean, just in case you thought
Dr. Martin Luther King saying freedom.
Yeah, right. Just in case you thought that there was going to be even the gentlest pushback from anybody not named Ducey in that D.C. press corps for these briefings.
And what is he going to be, the Jim Acosta of Fox?
Yeah, but at least he'll have some decorum. Just ask the questions.
I'd like to know when Glenn Kessler, what he will sing in his parody show tune at the Gridiron Club. At the Gridiron Club, where they, which is one of the reasons why I got kicked out of that thing. You wear a white tie and tail. And then you go to a dinner, and they do show tunes.
Well, or how about
show tunes where, like, say, for example, John McKay. I mean, John Glenn covering up for the China money that Clinton got, and then they put him in a show, and all the reporters were singing to him in a show.
Yeah,
Ground Control to Major Tom or something. It's pathetic. This is journalism.
Hey,
thank you.
The important thing is that they're all happy and content. And the immortal words of John Heilman, all our heroes were back like the Avengers. The Clintons, the Obamas, the Bushes, all of our heroes. For more on our heroes, we're pleased to be joined by Thaddeus McCotter again. He's the former chairman of the Republican House Policy Committee. He's American Greatness, amgreatness.com contributor, and the Monday co-host of the John Batchelor Show. Thaddeus McCotter, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So no need for fact checkers now that we have a President Biden.
Well, it's insane. And he gives away the game when he talks about how he expects the Biden administration to be better. He has no proof for his estimate that they will be telling the truth. So he just wants to do it. And he's just going to do it. I mean, it's a total abdication of their responsibility as journalists to hold both sides accountable. And it's very disturbing for a free society to have a press that's in the tank from one party or the other.
Yeah. Meanwhile, speaking of disturbing, Biden asking his DNI to assess domestic extremism. And here we go. Glenn Greenwald has written about this, too. The prospect of a new war on terrorism that's directed inwardly against people that they describe as terrorists because in many cases they just have differences of opinion on policy matters.
Well, it's the red state scare is really what it is. So when you look at it, the left's relationship with political violence is not one that inspires confidence to set up this domestic terrorist investigation. When you think about it, these are people who put pictures of Chairman Mao above their mantel place, a mass murderer who killed millions. When you look at the pictures of Che Guevara as radical chic on their T-shirts, these are people who spent all summer rationalizing and justifying away violence in pursuit of a political goal. Unfortunately, that's not the type of political violence they're talking about. It seems to be that they're trying to tar anybody who supports the Republican Party and President Trump and that policy agenda as potential domestic terrorists. And as you know, that's not a call for unity, so much of which we heard about all through the inaugural.
Speaking of unity, I've got to ask you, given your long expertise in Washington, what do you make of the moves of Mitch McConnell?
First, I live in Detroit.
You live in Detroit now. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
You know something of the ways of our modern Versailles, don't you?
Yeah, yes. Some things you just can't forget, no matter how hard you try.
when you look at what McConnell's trying to do, he's trying to walk a tightrope, isn't he? You're hearing about the president talking about a potential Patriot Party. You're hearing rumblings amongst the Republican senatorial caucus that they do not wish to be primaried by people running in the Patriot Party. Again, just to draw the distinction, that's just a wing of the Republican Party. He's not setting up an entirely different Patriot Party because obviously they'll be running in Republican primaries. So what Senator McConnell is trying to do is trying to walk a tightrope that Nancy Pelosi's put in front of him without tripping on it and falling 30,000 feet to demise as political majority, as a minority leader. I think it's a very difficult task to do. Clearly, they should first figure out whether or not this is constitutional at all, which I don't think it is, because can you imagine being able to go back in the past and, like with Oliver Cromwell digging up the bones and putting the head on a pike, you could go after anybody who's out of public life with an impeachment process and try to do it for partisan political reasons, which is exactly what we're seeing now.
I wanted to get your take on Joe Biden, the standard bearer for Catholicism, because you write about in a piece at amgreatness.com recently, as a Catholic Union-supporting Democrat, no doubt my father would have believed President Donald Trump was a BS artist, especially given his background as a New York real estate mogul. But you also say he would have surely voted for Trump at least once. The New York Times and the New Yorker, doing what they are wont to do whenever there is a public expression of faith, particularly from someone who believes in the Catholic label but not the catechism, like Joe Biden. In Biden's Catholic faith, an ascendant liberal Christianity is the headline of the New York Times this weekend. Can Joe Biden save American Catholicism from the far right? In other words, can Joe Biden save American Catholicism from the catechism? And there's comparisons to how they treated, how they're treating Joe Biden and his Catholic faith as compared to, for example, the dogma living loudly within Amy Coney Barrett. And I just wanted your comment about the coverage of Joe Biden wearing his, stylized social justice, politicized Catholicism on his sleeve.
Well, he's a cafeteria Catholic. He picks and chooses what he wants. He doesn't follow the strict teachings of the Catholic Church, the infallible doctrine that's been put forward, the catechism. And I think that any Catholic that looks to the New Yorker or the New York Times as the standard bearer for what is Catholicism, as if it's the new Baltimore Catechism, is making a grave mistake. It's scandalous, if you think about it. Well, the Catholic Church has a very difficult dilemma on its hands, and it seems to me that they have to make a clear distinction. For those Catholics who are promoting not only abortion here at home, but spending taxpayer money to do it and sending taxpayer money abroad to perform abortions, that is not the new Catholicism. That's called heresy.
And what about on matters of men playing in women's sports, matters of transgender individuals in the military?
I think it goes to the larger point that we're seeing. We talked about the whole article of Joe Biden. I didn't use the word malarkey because that's not the word my father used. but BS is what it is. When you think about it, look, he talks about like he's supporting union people, but then he acts as the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
And puts tens of thousands of people out of work and destroys the economy and decimates the economy of places like New Mexico, which voted for him. When you look at a lot of the suburban soccer moms that voted for him, now their daughters are going to be have a very difficult time getting athletic scholarships now because of the competition with men that are turning into women or whatever. And so when you look at the final analysis of this, Biden talks a good game, but the policies that he is already pursuing are decidedly different from what he has promised people.
But we can see that the parts of this Biden coalition are against each other already. You have the feminists upset about the transgender thing. You've got big corporate, big government, big tech, and hard left in the same coalition. What holds it together, except perhaps the flayed skins of conservatives on the pyre of free speech? What holds that thing together?
Well, I think your point that you made earlier about McConnell is absolutely appropriate here, because they're trying to keep Trump front and center, because that does unite the disparate elements of the Democratic Party, that and redistribution of wealth. Some of the culture war does and doesn't work. Obviously, woke progressives do not match well with relatively conservative union members. But we saw who won that battle with Keystone Pipeline. So So when you're looking at it, this is why they have to do the impeachment. This is why, in some ways, it's very much a mistake for Senator McConnell to keep playing along, because the longer the Dems get to pretend that Donald Trump is still a relevant factor in the way that Washington is operating now, which he is not in terms of policies being implemented, it is the Biden administration, the longer it's going to take for the Republican Party and the populist supporters of the president to turn around and start looking towards the 2022 elections, which are critical right now.
He is Thaddeus McCarter, former chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee, American Greatness contributor, amgreatness.com, Monday co-host of the John Batchelor Show as well. Thaddeus McCarter, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and John Cass in for Amy J.
That's the lovely John Cass.
Lovely.
How much time we got?
Lovely leggy. A couple minutes here. Hold on a second. Let's get some reaction to our conversation with Thaddeus McCarter. Glenn in the South Suburbs.
Yes. Good morning, guys. I would just like to say that the Build Back Better campaign of Biden post-election would be Biden, Malarney, and Bullscat. On the same day, he puts the United States back into the Paris Accords. He sticks an eye in Canada. He sticks his finger in the eye in Canada by stopping the Keystone Pipeline, which will do what? Which will enable China to supply pipe from China to put that pipeline to the west coast of Canada. And as they're building all this pipe to put it there, which I'm sure they will buy, Canada will buy it from them. As they're building it all, pollute more. Rationale in Democrats, non-existent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Glenn.
Thanks, Glenn. You know what I'd like to say? I'm glad Glenn touched on what Dalrymple talked about. I know I'm going to embarrass Dan here.
Uh-oh, what did I do now?
Because if you talk about Dan in this way, he gets embarrassed. But I'm going to keep it clean, okay?
Oh, please.
The thing is, I hope you understand that there's no place in radio where you can hear what you heard about from Dalrymple and many of the other guests that come on the show. I mean, you could hear it on certain podcasts, but you don't hear it with him doing it. And I just hope you understand and I hope Salem understands what a treasure. Because looking around at the radio landscape, Danny, all I see is mush, conventional mush. And there's no meat there, no bone there for people to chew on and think about.
It was a great Clara Peller impersonation you did there. Where's the beef? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's me. When I jump up, Kristen texted me saying, is Dan protecting you from COVID?
Yeah.
I've got this glass. If you in front of me, this,
yeah,
plexiglass. But I if I wasn't fat and old, I would really like to jump over there now.
Well, I appreciate
give you a couple.
I appreciate the sentiment and of course agree
yeah.
with it.
Yeah, the slapping part.
I agree with that. I deserve to be slapped and the other stuff you said, the nice stuff you said too.
Right.
No, I do appreciate it and. Of course, it's always wonderful to have you here because you aid and abet that. No, it is. I mean, as I said, I opened the show, the last consequential columnist in Chicago.
Yeah.
That's my opinion, but I think it's true. And happy to have you. Stick around as long as you can or want to.
I'm going to stick around as long as I can. I'm going to turn the lights out. That's how I feel.
All right. Well, I'll be long gone by then. So let me know when you flip the switch.
All right, man.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks.